In 1942, the first training center for the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps opened at Fort Des Moines. Today, I'll talk with a woman who trained there, but that's only a small part of her remarkable World War II story. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Audie Blody was born in Austria. She moved to the United States just as World War II was getting underway. She left behind her medical student fiancé. She eventually joined the U.S. Army, and he was conscripted into the German Army. This hour, she'll tell us their story. And later, I'll talk with historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni about Iowa's role in preparing women for war. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1942, the first training center for the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps opened at Fort Des Moines. Later this hour, I'll talk about the history of the training center with historian Tom Moraine. But first, one of the women who came to Des Moines to do her training was a young woman named Audie Schmackall. Now, she is Audie Blody. She is 95 years old, and she lives in a retirement home in Iowa City. I recently visited her to learn about her remarkable life story. Good morning, Audie.
Good morning, everybody.
Thank you so much for letting us come and visit with you today. And I want to go back in time, a long way. You were born in Austria.
I was born in Vienna, 1917. You can't even remember how long ago that is.
And you, as you were growing up, you spent most of your childhood living with your aunt?
Yes. My mother was a widow then, and must have been a friend of her, was expecting her third child in New York City, where she lived. And she wanted someone to help her with. There was some problem with the children. She had two other children. And so my mother came to the States and stayed there till everything was sort of ironed out. And like 99% of the people who come to America, they say, oh, I'm only coming for a short time. And the short time is an endless one.
Is a lifetime.
Is a lifetime.
So your mother was living in the United States in New York City, and you stayed behind in Vienna with your aunt.
Yeah.
And as you were growing up, there was a young man who lived in the same community that you lived in named Fred Blody.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We sort of grew up together because he went to the boys. The higher schooling is called gymnasium, and it was a boys' school and a girls' school, and we had part of the same way going home, and so we did. And he was one of the nicer boys. Boys, they can't help it. They get kind of silly at a certain age. Girls grow up quicker. They want to show off, let's face it. And boys, they get into everything, pick up every stone on the path, and you know. But this one was a little different.
So as you were growing up together, when did you become more than just companions for the walk home?
Well, 14. We did most everything together because it was a smaller town about half hour away from Vienna. And so we went to dancing school together, skating together, we went whatever. In the summer, swimming, diving, whatever there was to do, we did it. So we knew each other very well. But then when I came to the States the first time, it was 39, I think. And it wasn't long after, and Hitler moved into Austria.
Before that, you and Fred were sweethearts. Had you talked about getting married?
Well, yeah, more or less. We were together for most everything.
Mm-hmm. And he was in medical school?
Yeah, he was in medical school. Once in a while, we had a little, brawl or whatever you call it.
Most people do.
Yeah, most people did. And he would send a letter and thank me for the nice days, and we wouldn't go to see each other anymore, and, you know, the whole bit. But I was here in this country, I think, visiting my mother, and Hitler marched into Austria.
So you were back in Austria?
I was
after...
there just visiting, just, to, you know.
Right. What was it like? What was the atmosphere
on the
like?
Hitler?
Right, when once Hitler had invaded Poland and you were back in Austria, what were things like? What were people saying?
When he was in Austria, they all warned me to keep quiet. That was the biggest thing. Don't voice any opinions, please.
Was that a problem for you?
No, well, you know, I'm very outspoken. So it's a problem. Very outspoken. But
so,
I did. I was very careful. And the first thing, that was 1939, when my husband, my boyfriend, was, what do you call it, called into the army.
Conscripted into the army, yeah. Right.
And
for the Germans.
Yeah, well, Austria was already overtaken, overrun by Germany. Yeah, for the German. Fortunately, he had gone to summer school, and they credited him that and let him finish.
So he got to pursue his education.
That was 1939.
He was not fighting on the front line because
he
was
wasn't
in school.
At all. He wasn't fighting at all. He had to wear a uniform for certain parades or something, but they let him finish medical school.
So you went back then to the United States.
Yes. So he says, you go back. It won't be long. Or his father. His father was a lawyer, and I always believed him, but he was just trying to get me in a safe place, I think he said that.
When you said goodbye to Fred, when you came to the United States, did you think that maybe you had seen him for the last time?
No, because you can have no idea how long a war lasts and things like that. And I always tried to have him come over for certain occasions, you know, big thing going on here, but he would never get a permit. It was pathetic.
How much communication were you able to have with him after you came to the United States and he was still there?
Well, in the beginning, we still had letters. Then I had a girlfriend in Italy that was not involved yet or overtaken. And so by a roundabout way, we did it through Italy, through her.
Okay, you could send her a letter, she could send it to Fred, he could send her a letter, yeah. And she could send
or
it to you.
Or she would just take it. She moved back and forth in okay. her job. So, and I tried to get him here to the World's Fair and things like that, but he would never get a permit. And he had to graduate in uniform, which was just awful.
Why was that so awful?
Because we were against it. They had overtaken Austria, and Austria is a very small country, but it was a terrible period when the Nazis were there. And people always think that Adolf Hitler didn't have a brain. Adolf Hitler applied for the university and didn't make it. And that's one of the things that made him so angry. And, of course, he couldn't talk. Did you ever listen to any speech by him? Oh, you should. It really, not the whole speech, but he just barked a few words into it. They had excellent speakers, the Germans, but he wasn't one of them, you know.
So while Fred was stuck over there, you were in New York City, and you mentioned the World's Fair.
Yeah.
What was life like for you? It must have been so different.
Well, I was not that happy about it, but you know, you're young and you always have hopes. And so later on, we only conversed in 25 words.
Why is that?
Well, that's the rule. That was the rule. 25 words sending and 25 words from him coming. And not too often either, maybe twice a year or something.
Wow. And how long would it take for those 25 words to travel from him to you?
Oh, it wouldn't. I don't know. They wouldn't tell. You know, everything was controlled. Everything was controlled. Nothing came through. After my girlfriend, I don't know, I think she got married and went to Vienna. She was Italian. Then I didn't have a place anymore. And then anyway, Italy got into the war, so my opening was shut.
Right. So after you were in the United States for 5 years, then you were able to become a citizen of the United States.
Yeah, I did. And then when I became a citizen, I joined the Army.
The Women's Auxiliary Corps of the Army.
Yeah.
Right.
And I trained in Des Moines.
Yeah. In Des Moines, Iowa. What did you think when you got sent to
Des Moines,
Iowa?
Never will I come back here. Never. Never will I come. It's too hot in the summer, too cold in the winter. Well, it turned out all right. And they sent me to Europe. And that was very nice.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. You joined the Army. You go into your training. Had you heard from Fred? Did you know where he was?
Well, after a while, until Hitler went into Italy, then I had no more sources to send it to me. And the only thing you could do legally through the Red Cross, 25 words. And they are controlled, what you say. You can't say this is a lousy outfit or something like that. You know, I am fine. I hope you are fine. We're doing well. 25 words.
So really, it was just a message to say, I'm still alive.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it did.
Now, did you ever think
of marrying anybody
else? Right,
of
moving on.
Yes, I had a very nice boyfriend. Eventually, you know, I've been with a boy most of my adult life, just knowing him. Mm-hmm. And I went to the YMCA to go swimming and things like that. And I met this guy, and he happened to be very nice. And we really didn't go out too much. I had him over. My mother, of course, was so set on my husband-to-be, Fred, you know. She just ignored the guy. I was so ashamed. She wouldn't talk to you. Oh, my God. And it isn't that I had so many boyfriends, but this was a very nice guy. He knew my story and all that. Well, anyway, he went to war and I went to war.
I'm talking with Audie Blody, who lives in Iowa City. She is now 95 years old. We're looking back on her remarkable life story and a remarkable love story. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In a few minutes, I'll talk with historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University about the history of the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps in Iowa during World War II. Fort Des Moines became the first training center for WACs during the war. But right now, my guest is someone who was there. Audie Blody moved to the United States from her native Austria in 1939. She left behind her medical student fiancé. He was conscripted into the German Army. She became a U.S. citizen and eventually joined the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. For 6 long years, she and her fiancé, Fred Blody, tried to keep in touch, but it was impossible, and they lost contact. Audie went through her training in Des Moines, started her career as a WAC, and eventually she was sent overseas. I asked her to tell me how that happened.
First, you had to come back to Des Moines for overseas training. They train you just in case you go anywhere. So you had to climb all these things and run down and throw yourself on the ground and God knows what, you know, what the army does. So anyway, I came back to Europe. And the biggest thing was, how am I ever going to find my boyfriend or fiancé or whatever. And I was stationed in Germany outside the big, big, big company. They had taken it over, and I can't think of the name, and had a very nice man in charge and mainly interpreting. People came for all kinds of things. They had to leave the whole town, the whole town. And it was a town that the officers had lived in. And they came with various questions, and I had to translate all that, you know. Could they get another horse for the farming, you know, and things like that, all sorts of things. And interview people. I interviewed the guy who makes the sunglasses and something else he did. I can't think of his name now. And he tried to get out of it all the time. And I kept saying, well, I know what you did and when you did it, so don't try so hard. But, you know, people try no matter what.
So while you were working, you knew that you wanted to try to find Fred.
Yeah.
But did you have any idea where he was?
Not exactly. Not. I knew he was alive, but I didn't know, you know. I mean, I hadn't heard that he was dead, and that would surely be written to me. But I didn't know much else, no. So I finally got the permit to go for a visit, a week, 10 days, something like that. And I finally got to Austria. I got permits to fly. And it was early afternoon, and they deposited me where the American headquarters was. And from then on, then they said, well, you can do anything you want right now, but such and such time, I don't know, 7 or 8 o'clock, we'll take you to your sleeping area. There's a WAC outfit, and we have arranged, and blah, blah, blah. Oh, so I thought I'll go around and try to find Fred.
Now, you knew he was a doctor.
Yeah,
so
I knew he was a doctor.
Starting with hospitals made sense, right?
Well, I didn't know if he was working at the hospital. I had no idea.
Okay, so how
did
you...
The kids say the force was with you.
Right, the force was with you. How did you even start looking for him?
Well, I knew by then you could write 25 words, you know, through the Red Cross. And I knew that he was alive. So he must be somewhere in a hospital working. And I walked from where they deposited me, headquarters, American headquarters. They said I could walk around Vienna, whatever I want to. And I walked a little while, and the first place I came around used to be a very beautiful park. But I noticed that it had been taken over by the army for treatment.
So it was a makeshift hospital.
Yeah, that's the word, makeshift hospital. And so they have a guard sitting outside, a real old man. And I asked him if they have a Dr. Blody. And he said yes.
The first place you went?
The first place I went.
Oh, wow.
First place I went.
So he said, yes, we do. Then what happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, Dr. Blody may not really want to see me anymore. I mean, I didn't know anything. And it's a long area. Now, again, is a park, but it was filled with facilities to have the sick, okay, the ill. And his was way down. And so, of course, I ran in my uniform. And two nuns came in. Nuns always go in twos. Did you know that? I mean, they had to be in twos so they wouldn't defect. And they stopped me. And they said, you cannot be in here like this.
You can't run. You were inappropriate.
I had a skirt. It was short, too short. Oh, God. I says, go away, go away. I think, I mean, here I am. Anyway, it was the last little temporary hospital that they had down there. And so I walked in, and the guard came and asked him if they had a Dr. Blody, and he said yes, and he's in. So I scared Fred to death.
What did he say when he saw you?
Well, we were speechless. And there's no place to sit, you know. You know where we sat? It's unbelievable. But telephone cells years ago were quite large and had little seats in them.
So you sat in a phone booth to talk?
We went into the telephone booth. That was the only place to sit down. I felt kind of weak. And, well, he was really, I don't know, headstruck or what. He had no idea I was coming. I couldn't tell him. Oh, of course. And then we went to some friends of his, and we talked.
Well,
and we still felt the same.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so that was nice.
And you must have had so much to share with each other, because he had actually gotten arrested and gone to prison.
Yeah.
Because he had tried to help some Austrians who did not want to be conscripted into the German army. He had tried to help them resist. He wound up in prison.
Well,
there must have been so much to learn.
Slowly I heard about it. And then I always make mistakes. I don't know how come. Fred was in this prison. It's a beautiful area, that little country. Fortunately, he was there only maybe 6 months or something like that. And since he was a physician and so, and didn't really do anything so terrible, they led him or asked him to help out a little for the inmates, whatever they had, little things. There wasn't much medication or anything, but he helped out. He and a friend he became acquainted to. And the war was over, and of course, a large part of the prisoners were political prisoners. And the man who ran the prison said, had all the people gathered in the outside area, I don't know, 100 or many hundred, a few hundred, except a guide whom Fred must have given some food once a while or some help with medical things. I didn't want to dig too deep. Anyway, he locked him and his aide, which he needed sometimes for medical things to carry a person, in one of the cells and locked them in and told him to be quiet. And the head of the prison asked all the prisoners to come in the main front area. It's a big yard. Some of them had already left the prison, and they found them on the way walking. You know, they had prison clothes, you couldn't tell. And some of the top Nazis in the area were so upset about that when they heard that the prisoners would be let go. They came in with the machine guns and whatever they had, put it all around the outside, had all the prisoners land up here, and just shot them all. Just like that.
Wow.
It was just ghastly.
And that guard saved Fred's life.
Yeah, there were court discussions about it 20, 30 some years later, but That didn't change much. They said it was the townspeople who were so upset that all the prisoners had been let out. And excuses. And then he didn't know what to do, so he stayed for a little while. The country was divided into American area, French, and what the others were. And British, of course, and so on. So he went into, I think, a British area and worked in the hospital a little. And then finally, of course, they got homesick and for their families and all that. They liberated a canoe on the Danube. It was quite a big one, hefty. I saw it. And canoed themselves down to Vienna.
So when the two of you got back together and you realized you still felt the same way about each other, did you decide right away that you wanted to get married right there and then?
Oh, yeah. We always wanted to get married. We had a wonderful wedding. The army was just... The army has priests working for the various denominations. And this one was a top guy. And he wanted to show, and we married in the emperor's private little church, so to speak. We were both Catholic. And I decided to marry in uniform. I like, and if I didn't have anything else, and I was old enough, I liked my uniform. So I'm Fred just in a suit, and I have it somewhere. And we were ready to go in, and the nun, a little nun, came, and she says, "You can't go in. You can't go down there without a hat."
So you had to cover your head.
I had a hat, but in the army, you can't wear a hat when you're inside four walls. It has to come off first thing. And I said, "I have a hat here." Well, she was aghast. Finally, this very nice minister came, and he took something out of my flower bouquet, put it on my head, said, "This is her hat."
Because you had to have your head covered.
Yeah, with the flower.
Uh-huh, nice.
So, yeah.
So when you got married, you were a U.S. citizen. Did you know right away that you wanted to move back to the United States, or did you think about staying in Austria?
Well, we wanted to go back. And Fred had a scholarship from a large company. I don't know what they made, one of those big companies. And so that was a very nice thing. And he said, "Yeah, well, I'll try it." And I said, "Well, we'll try it." And he loved it.
Well, laws have changed, of course, but what was the law that allowed you to bring your husband back to the United States? I mean, you were in the army, so...
The army, I was married. I got mm-hmm. married officially. Mm-hmm. You had to get permission, of course.
Well, I'm just guessing that a lot more couples had men bringing women back with than women bringing men back. That must have been unusual.
Wherever we were called... They called him Frederica. You have to go up to the boat finally, you know. Women first, Frederica. Well, he took it.
So when you came to the United States, where did you live?
With my mother. She lived...
Who must have been very happy, right?
She was, but she just had a very small place outside New York City, in Queens, you know. And we had to sleep on the couch in the living room. And Fred earned $200 a month with this big hospital there, very neat. And one day, the man, Al Braley from Iowa City, very nice man, very outgoing, friendly, and he came, "Finally, I see you." Clapped him on the shoulder. "Hello, Fred." So they got to talking and things like that. And he said, "Well, if you ever want to come to our area or at least look at it," and blah, blah, blah. So we did. He looked at some of the other places, and finally he said, "Let's look at Iowa." And so we did, and we just loved it.
Audie Blody lives in Iowa City. She is 95 years old. She and her husband, Dr. Frederick Blody, moved together to Iowa in 1952, where he became chair of the ophthalmology department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and one of the most famous ophthalmologists in the world. In a moment, we'll talk about Iowa's role in training the women of the Women's Army Corps. Here's a moment from a WAC recruiting video from 1944.
There goes one of those petticoat soldiers now.
Yeah. My sister wants to join the WACs. What do you think of that?
She's crazy. What the devil's a woman want to be a soldier for?
Just a waste of time. This is a man's war. What sort of jobs can they do?
What sort of jobs can we do? Take a look, mister. X-ray technicians, inspectors of army meat. Teachers schooling our soldiers. WACs are classification experts. Assignment interviewers.
So this is a man's war, is it? WACs are at work on every sort of army vehicle, doing every sort of motor transport job. Testing walkie-talkies, testing radio tubes. Those are just a few of the jobs they do.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. More than 150,000 women served in the Women's Army Corps during World War II. They were called WACs. The Corps was created in May of 1942 and was first called the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. The very first training center for WACs opened at Fort Des Moines. The first women arrived in Des Moines for training on July 20th of 1942. And with me to talk about this period of Iowa history and some of the other roles that Iowa played in World War II is historian Tom Moraine. He is the director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. Hello, Tom.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And the audio that we just heard a moment ago from a WAC recruitment video or film a few minutes ago leads me to believe that there was some controversy when this division of the Army was founded. What was the need that the Army was trying to fill with women? There
was a general labor shortage in many, many occupations once the war started. Leading up to the war was the Depression, and unemployment was a problem. But immediately when the war started, there was recruiting into the Army, and people were leaving, or men were leaving their jobs in industry and on the farm. Those jobs still needed to be done. And the only major source of labor that wasn't or that was available was women. But there were social norms and social beliefs that had to be overcome about putting women in some of those jobs.
Certainly, and particularly against putting women in uniform.
Yeah, the military was always seen as a male enclave. The male protects the home. The male is the fighter and protecting the women and children at home. That was the myth. But in this case, they needed labor. They needed people to do some of those jobs, and women were the available labor source.
And what would make a woman at that time eligible to enlist?
Eligible to enlist?
Right. So what were the age groups, and were they just single women? Could they be married?
I think it was mostly single women. I think it would have been difficult for marriage women or married women. But at that time, it was not unknown for couples to hide their married status because there were prohibitions against women holding certain jobs, particularly public jobs. In the Depression, it was thought if there's a public job, it should go to a family that needs it and not the second income that was assumed a woman would be. But in just for practical reasons, it would be single women who were going into these jobs and not married women.
And if a woman became pregnant while she was working for the Women's Army Corps or enlisted in the Women's Army Corps, she would be immediately discharged.
That's right. The public perception and the public comfort with pregnant women in public was much different from today. And it was something that you disguised or stayed out of public for as long as possible and as much as possible.
Now, so many of the images that I have seen growing up and looking through history books of wax are they're patriotic images. These are women we should be proud of. But at the time, what was the public reaction to these women?
Well, it was a mixed reaction. One of the popular posters was "It's My War Too," and it was a picture of a woman in uniform. The idea that she was doing this out of love for her country, that she, like her male partner, could say, "I want to serve my country," and that was okay. For her to say, "I want to do this as a lifetime career," put her at odds with the norm that women's goal should be to be wives and mothers and be in the home with a family. So this is the participation of women in the war was seen as a temporary war expedient, not as a lifetime career.
Right. I'm talking with historian Tom Moraine. We're talking about the Women's Army Corps and the very first training center for the Women's Army Corps, which was in Des Moines, Iowa. If your family has some history with the wax, we'd love to hear your story as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And why, if you know, why was Fort Des Moines chosen as the first training center for wax?
I'm not sure why it was. It was probably available. It had been a training center in World War I, and interestingly, it had been the first training center for black officers. The black officers' training center had been in Des Moines. They probably wanted one outside of the segregated South, and the Des Moines facilities were available. So probably this was a training center that was open. And it could be adapted to the WAC training program.
And speaking of race, there were 40 African Americans who were among that first class of WACs to be trained
in
Des Moines.
And they were segregated. The Army was segregated during World War II. It was Harry Truman in a very bold and progressive move after the war, I think it was about 1948 or 49, who said, "We're going to integrate the Army," and just did it by fiat to great, great consternation. But, you know, it happened. The Army did not fall apart. And those kinds of things do have a major impact on social perception that sort of laid some groundwork for some later desegregation activities as well. But in World War II, it was segregated. I believe even the blood banks were separated, black and white, in terms of who could get whose blood.
As these women went through their training and started their roles, I'm sure things evolved over time. But can you give me an idea of some of the roles that WACs filled in the Army?
Well, they would fill non-combat role, clerk role, stenographer role, some of those things. I remember there was an article about General Eisenhower when the Army moved into northern Africa, called for some WACs. He was looking for French translators. They needed people who could deal with the local population and spoke French, but it would be in a secretary or clerical role, not out in the public. But women could take jobs that needed to be done that would free men to do combat roles, and that was the motivation to get women into the Army.
With so many civilian jobs available for women during World War II, because as you mentioned, the men went to war, so there were lots of farm jobs and factory jobs and other jobs available for women during that time, what would have made the Army attractive to women?
It was interesting because enrollments at the start of the war were heavier than enrollments later in the war. As factory jobs opened with higher salaries and a greater freedom a lot of women wanted to move into the factory jobs that would create less dislocation in their lives than being subject to moved around with the army. But there was an appeal of the army too, the adventure, the same thing that appealed to men. I'm gonna see the world. I'm gonna experience opportunities that I would not get to do. That was an appeal to some women as opposed to taking a factory job.
It started out as the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, and then in 1943 it became the Women's Army Corps after legislation was signed by FDR. What did that change mean? What's the difference between an auxiliary corps and a corps?
Well, you become part of the Army. You become under the Army General Command in a way that the auxiliaries were not. I'm not sure on all the details of how that happened, but there was resistance within the military in some quarters of saying the Army is not a place for women. We don't want to have to adjust to that. But when it becomes part of the regular structure, then the women's officers are subject to the same rules and the same chains of command that the men would be.
And the same benefits?
Now, I think I heard that the pay was the same, but because they were not in combat roles, they didn't get the same death benefits. I don't know if they got the same veterans' health benefits after the war. I don't know on those, but I think the pay grades were the same.
All right. Yes, and we're getting some confirmation here from our producer that pay was the same, but the benefits were not.
We have a family story that relates something to this. It wasn't quite the Army, but it was the Civilian Pilot Training Corps. Even before we entered into World War II, some people said we're going to need a lot more pilots when this happened, or when the war comes along, and they could do that under the guise of we're going to promote pilot training to boost aviation, rather than saying we're going to train these as wartime, because there was resistance to anything that said we're preparing for war. So my aunt in Des Moines joined the civilian pilot training program, and she was a school teacher. She was a kindergarten teacher by day, but then in the evening she would go down to the airport and get into a pair of overalls. They'd take apart airplane engines. They learned how to fly. She got her complete pilot's license at government expense during war, because the idea was female pilots could ferry planes from Detroit or wherever they were being built to the training stations across the nation and get the planes there that would free up male pilots mm-hmm. for combat duty. So a lot of women and men joined the civilian pilot training program. They got all of their flight expenses paid. They learned how to fly. My aunt never got to do the ferrying work because the war ended by the time she got her license. But she said there would be women coming in fur coats. They'd hang up that fur coat in their locker. They'd put on dungarees, and they'd tear apart an airplane motor and grease it up and put it back together. And that was just an opportunity that women never would have had except for the war. I mean, to get something mechanical and to be taught at government expense how to fly airplanes, just such an expansion of opportunity for women to do, that was exciting. And Aunt Gretchen was one who would have taken full advantage of that when the opportunity came along.
Did she ever fly after the war?
Oh, yeah. She had her pilot's license for some time. She had a brother in Burlington, so she would rent a plane in Des Moines, fly to Burlington for the day, and fly back home solo by herself. She was fine with that. But when she got married and her husband saw her doing loop-de-loops in the sky on some of her training flights, he said, I can't I can't have you doing that. It was just too much of a strain for him to watch her doing some of her flights to keep up her license. So he said, "Will you stop that?" And she did. But she enjoyed it while she did it.
Tell me about the Ottumwa Naval Air Station. That was also operational during the war in Iowa, right?
I'm not as much familiar with the naval station. The one thing I know is that's where Richard Nixon served his military time in World War II. And I didn't get I haven't really done the work on why there was a naval station in Ottumwa.
All right. What were some of the other ways that Iowa was involved in preparing for the war and so and in supporting the war effort? Obviously, we were growing a lot of food.
Yes, agriculture was the major way Iowa participated in the war, and it was a major accomplishment. With the start of the war, we now had an army to feed. We were trying to feed our allies. And when you think about it, if you're in a combat zone, it's hard to get a crop if tanks are rolling across your soybeans or whatever. So the need to produce meat and foodstuffs, grains for the Allies was a major part of the war effort. The Extension Service at Iowa State did a heroic job of getting the best techniques out. And one of the things that happens before the war, there were hired hands, farm laborers, but the Army soaked those up pretty quick. Those were usually single men who had a high draft status, so they were taken out. So farmers had to produce more with less, and they used the farm machinery. They got new machinery whenever they could, but those John Deere plants and others that had been producing combines and tractors, those were now producing war goods, so you couldn't get new farm equipment. So keeping your old stuff running was a major problem, but Iowa farmers and farm families did a heroic job in boosting food production during the war.
Tom, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Historian Tom Moraine, he is also the director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. He's the former head of the Iowa State Historical Society. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And you can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow on the show, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.